The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. My guest for the next hour is Sam Keen. Sam was fairly recently on the show to talk with guest host Rochelle Saunders about his last book, The Disappearing Spoon, which was a New York Times bestseller and was also a finalist for the Royal Society Prize for Best Science Book of the Year. He writes for Science Magazine, and he's appeared on All Things Considered, Radiolab, and Fresh Air. His new book is The Violinist's Thumb, a collection of lost stories about human history buried in our DNA. Welcome back, Sam.
Hello.
Why don't you start off by telling us about the inspiration for this book, the story behind the title?
The title story is about a violinist, Niccolo Paganini. He's usually considered the greatest violinist who ever lived. He was playing for emperors and popes and kings throughout Europe in the early 1800s. And he was really gifted, his hands especially. He had these kind of amazingly, freakishly flexible hands. And that was part of the reason why he was such a good violinist, was he had these hands. He could twist into all sorts of knots. He could stretch them incredibly wide. There were actually rumors that he had sold his soul to Satan to get those hands, that was the gift that Satan gave him, was these just incredible hands that allowed him to do things that other violinists simply could not. And that was what sort of set him apart from other violinists. And it's almost certain that Paganini had a genetic disorder, and that was why he had these amazingly flexible hands. And I liked it for the title of the book for a few reasons. First of all, it explains that, or it shows how it was really his environment and his genes working together that made him who he was, because in addition to his hands, he also was really passionate about music, and he was an extremely hard worker too. So it was kind of a perfect storm of that temperament coming together in a person that had a genetic endowment in order to take advantage of it. So we're really lucky all of those traits came together in one person. And the other reason that I use the story is because while his genes kind of made him on the one hand, they kind of unmade him on the other hand, because the same thing that gave him such amazingly flexible hands was also a, it led to some health problems later in his life, led to a lot of joint problems and the lining of other tissues in his body. And he actually ended up dying quite young and unable to play music in public during the last years of his life. So again, while his genes helped him on the one hand, they ended up kind of hurting him on the other hand. So that's The Violinist's Thumb.
Now, the history of DNA, in addition to your book, is full of tons of fascinating stories. DNA itself was actually simultaneously discovered by two men just 400 miles from each other?
Yeah, it was actually DNA and genes, the two things that are kind of the basis of genetics today that we all build on for genetics. They were both discovered in the 1860s, and as you said, just very near each other in the middle of Europe. The genes were sort of famously discovered by Gregor Mendel, the monk who was growing pea plants in his garden, and he's the first one who figured out that there were these factors called genes that parents were passing down to their children each generation. The other man is much, much less well known. His name was Friedrich Miescher, and he was the one who discovered DNA, the substance, the chemical DNA. And he wasn't very well recognized for this work during his lifetime. They recognized that he had discovered DNA, but for a long time, and in fact, close to the 1950s, scientists didn't really understand that DNA was the important substance, that it was DNA that made up our genes, and it was DNA we would pass from parent to child. And so Miescher actually died without getting really any credit for having discovered something so fundamental. And it's kind of the same parallel story as Mendel. A lot of people know Mendel died without getting much recognition either, and it wasn't until almost 30 years later that people really recognized he'd done important work. But the same exact thing happened to the man who discovered DNA too. And it's just strange to think about the lives of these two men and their work running along parallel tracks like that.
Let's talk a bit about Mendel. And I feel bad because my shirt never gets discussed. But really, Mendel is a lot more interesting. So he was working on peas. Tell us about peas, sir.
Mendel was looking at some different traits of peas. He was looking at pea plants that were tall or short, or looking at plants that had yellow peas or green peas. And what Mendel did that was really important is he decided to look at one factor or one trait at a time. So instead of just looking at two parents that you'd cross to make offspring, the baby pea plant, so to speak, and trying to figure out the overall relationship and all these different traits, Mendel would isolate one trait at a time and just look at that one trait and how it got passed on to the baby pea plants. And that was really what allowed him to isolate the idea of genes and how they work. It's sort of an irony of history that Charles Darwin was also very interested in how things pass on traits to the next generation. And he tried to study pea plants himself to try to figure out how they worked and how the traits were getting passed on. But Darwin tried to look at all of the traits and how all of the traits got passed on. And it was kind of overwhelming. Mendel succeeded because he isolated traits. And that's really why he was able to do this great work. And probably the most important thing he figured out was that these traits, for instance, tall, it was a dominant trait. And so if a plant got one gene that was dominant, it was tall because it dominated the other gene. However, two tall plants could sometimes have a short plant because there might be recessive genes lurking inside their DNA. So he really provided a way for scientists to figure out how traits got passed down from generation to generation, and also how these sort of cryptic traits could pop up, what looked like unexpectedly, but he figured out, we can predict how often these hidden traits will pop up.
Well, there was some concern that he had falsified his data, right?
There was. Because if you're dealing with statistics, which is what Mendel was doing, the ratio of dominant to recessive traits should be around 3-1 if you look at the math behind it. But of course, when you're working in a real life setting, you never ever get a 3-1 ratio. You just get approximately a 3-1 ratio. Mendel, though, in his work, was getting some almost platonically perfect 3-1 ratios over and over again. And to a modern eye, that looks pretty suspicious,
right,
that he was getting these perfect traits. And we don't necessarily want to say he was committing fraud, because the standards for recording data were different back then. So he might have been unconsciously biasing his traits, or maybe he was just, like tidying them up a little for other people.
That's nice.
It was nice of him to do that for us. And there are scientists who kind of defend him still, but it does look a little suspicious. Unfortunately, we will never know, because his original lab books were destroyed. They were purposely burned by the people who took over after Mendel. Mendel was the head of his abbey for a while, and the people who took over actually burned all of his papers because Mendel had been involved in a few sort of scandalous incidents in his abbey. He got in a fight with the government over taxes and things like that, and they just decided it would be better to purge most of the traces of Mendel and move on, and some collateral damage in that purge was the original lab books of Mendel. So, sad story there.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Sam Keen, the author of The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. So what happened to Mendel, and I guess more appropriately to his theories?
They kind of went underground after a while. He published them, tried to get some recognition for them. He even was sending papers out to people like Darwin saying, hey, you know, would you look at this? But no one really paid much attention to it. They thought it was sort of an interesting exercise in growing peas. They didn't realize it had universal implications, that it wasn't just for growing some nice peas. It described how every living thing that we know passes on traits from parent to offspring. And so his ideas were basically ignored until right around 1900, in one of those strange simultaneous discoveries of history, when three different scientists, kind of hunting through footnotes, all came across Mendel's work at the same time. And at that point in history, their minds were kind of prepared to accept this kind of work, and all three of them began promoting Mendel's work. And in very short order, he became one of the, you know, great people in biology. He went from completely obscure to one of the leading lights of the era right around 1900.
And, you know, I guess at that point, Mendel's theory was actually considered incompatible with Darwin's theory of evolution, right?
Yeah, it's really strange for us to think about from this vantage point today. But right around 1900, there was what was known as the eclipse of Darwinism, because Darwin's theories were really taking a beating at the time, and they were really going into decline. It's not that people didn't believe in evolution. They believed that evolution happened. They just didn't believe that Darwin had gotten the theory of evolution, or I guess I should say the mechanism of evolution, natural selection. They didn't think Darwin was correct about that. And their basic beef with Darwin was they thought evolution happened very quickly. Darwin had always emphasized, no, that evolution happens very slowly. It's kind of an achingly slow process. But they wanted to think about evolution happening in jumps. They wanted to see, you know, a species emerging in one or a few generations. They thought about it moving very quickly. And Mendel's theory seemed to play into that idea of things happening very quickly. Because Mendel, again, he would find either tall or short pea plants, or he would have yellow peas or green peas or wrinkled peas or smooth peas. There wasn't a lot of blending, and there wasn't a lot it just seemed that there was a lot of jumping between generations with Mendel's peas in a way that there wasn't with Darwin's theories. And so a lot of people thought Mendel was maybe the new thing and that he would actually end up replacing Darwin's theories. And again, it's a little hard for us to understand today, but there were a lot of people who thought, you know, that Darwinism was going to die out. There's, in fact, a kind of an infamous quote by a German biologist who said that we're standing on the deathbed of Darwinism, and we're getting ready to send the friends of the patient a little money so they can have a decent burial. That's how close a lot of people thought Darwinism was to disappearing.
There weren't just scientific criticisms about Darwin's theory.
As with today, there were a lot of people who didn't like it for other reasons. And the reason why they didn't like it was Darwinism seemed really brutal. You always had to talk about creatures dying or starving or getting eaten or something like that. Mendel's traits really didn't – you didn't have to get into the gory details of nature like that. They were more emphasizing how creatures produce new traits, how they get new fantastic features, things like that. And so the emotion of that Darwinism brought up, kind of the abhorrence that it brought up in people, really turned a lot of people off. It was a new century, and sort of the spirit of the new century was kind of this progressive ethos of we're moving beyond our bare, raw nature, and Mendelism really seemed to fit better with that new ethos.
We actually have a question from the chat. This is from Bytor.
What were Mendel's opinions on evolution? Was he a Lamarckian?
That is something I've actually seen both ways. Some people say he hated evolution. Some people say he really liked Darwin's theory. So I've seen it both ways. We know that he had a copy of the German edition of Darwin's On the Origin of Species, and he marked it up a fair amount too, so we know that he read it. I think it's pretty consensus that he took the ideas very seriously, and I don't think he was vehemently or rabidly against them. And as far as the other part of the question about Lamarck, that one is also a little tricky too. Most people at the time did believe in some sort of Lamarckian traits, Lamarckian mechanisms, including Darwin. Just briefly, Lamarck was the idea that a trait that you acquire during your lifetime could be passed down. So it wasn't something that was inborn in you. It was a trait you acquired during your lifetime. So if you were a blacksmith and had big muscles, your children would get big muscles because you worked out a lot and got those nice thighs and tries and everything. So your children would kind of benefit from that as well. And so I would guess, although I'm not sure, I would guess that Mendel did believe in some sort of Lamarckianism, but probably less than other people given the work that he was doing on inborn traits.
We have a question from the chat from Gravespinner.
Did Mendel have any way to take into account genetic mutations?
Mendel really didn't know about anything on that level of genetic mutations. Mendel was more concerned about just having a parent and getting that trait from parent to a child. So he really didn't try to talk about mutations or anything like that. And it wasn't until after 1900 when they really started to take into account not only genes, but how genes change over time, generation to generation. So Mendel wasn't concerned with that or really working with that.
So this was resolved in part by a gentleman named Morgan and some fruit flies. And we'll be right back to talk more about DNA and evolution and fruit flies and such with Sam Keen, author of The Violinist's Thumb, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Sam Keen, the author of The Disappearing Spoon and The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. So let's talk about Thomas Morgan. How did he bring together the Darwinists and the Mendelians?
Mendelists.
Mendelists, good.
Mendelists, yeah.
Okay. What was he researching?
This is one of my favorite stories, I think, in the book, because Thomas Hunt Morgan was one of those people, you meet them sometimes in science, who were kind of allergic to big, grand theories. Morgan really liked facts. He wanted to see something happening in front of his eyes or he was kind of skeptical, didn't really believe it. And so Morgan was actually opposed to Darwin's theories and to Mendel's theories. It's kind of hard to figure out what Morgan did believe, but he didn't think that either one of those theories were very good. He thought there was too much speculation in them, not enough hard facts for his liking. So he actually set out to disprove both Mendel and Darwin. He thought he was going to knock them both down. And what he wanted to do was figure out, as everyone was trying to do, how creatures pass traits from parents to children. He tried it with a few different animals until someone suggested he try the fruit fly. And this really turned out to be a very good, easy animal to work with for genetic traits. All Morgan had to do was put some banana slices on his windowsill, and pretty soon there were tons of fruit flies there. He grabbed them, put them in a milk bottle, and that was the first generation of flies that became kind of the workhorse of modern genetics. He was working in Columbia University in New York in a very small room, only about 16 feet by 23 feet, and there were thousands of these milk bottles with flies in them in there. But the big advantage that fruit flies had, in addition to tolerating a lot of crowding, is that they reproduce very quickly, a new generation every 2 weeks or so. So instead of waiting a whole season, as you might have to with plants, or many months, even with most animals, Morgan was getting new generations every 2 weeks. And that allowed him to trace traits very quickly. He was also getting thousands and thousands of new flies all the time. So he really had a numbers advantage on his side in trying to do this work. And after he kind of gave up his prejudices against Mendel and Darwin, he and his assistants were very important in doing this too, but they all realized that they'd actually kind of married Mendel with Darwin. And they realized that Darwin explained sort of theoretically how evolution happened, and Mendel provided a good way to explain the mechanism, how exactly the traits were getting passed from parent to children. It was through these things called genes. And Morgan actually ended up winning a Nobel Prize for this work for doing the opposite of what he set out to do. So it's kind of a fun story of someone again, doing the exact opposite of what they set out to do, but being a good enough scientist to keep an open mind and to really pay attention to what he was doing and not let his theoretical prejudices kind of get in the way.
I was going to say, that's pretty much the definition of a good scientist.
Yeah, just keeping an open mind like that. And Morgan really deserves a lot of credit for not being too prejudiced against ideas. He would often, he kind of had a reputation as being notoriously stubborn. He just refused to accept things that other people were willing to accept. But when you could convince Morgan, he was completely happy to throw over his old ideas, give them up completely, and be very enthusiastic about the new ones. And that's really, really hard. It's really a rare trait that you find in any human endeavor, not just science. So he does deserve a lot of credit for that, I think.
Can we just go back to the flies for 1 second? Because the way that you explained these experiments, because this was not high tech.
No, they were basically breeding as many as they could in milk bottles. Morgan's assistants were got a little bit of a reputation for going by and swiping the milk bottles either from the cafeteria or their neighbor's stoops. That's how they built up their supply of milk bottles. And basically, they would just breed them, take them out, look at them under the microscope, see if they had any unusual traits or not. If they didn't, Morgan would usually just take his thumb and he would squash them. It didn't really matter where. He squashed them, smeared them in his lab book, all over the place. So he wasn't too careful or too sentimental about keeping the flies. Unfortunately, he also wasn't very clean either. They had a lot of rotten fruit sitting around. It attracted a lot of cockroaches, and mice were kind of scuttling through this room. It apparently had an awful, awful odor in it, which you can imagine, you know. All the flies in there, all the rotten fruit. There were also 8 desks in this room, even though it was only 16 by 23 feet. So there were also humans in there during a hot New York summer. You can about imagine what it smelled like. And it's just kind of amazing that all of this really fundamental, probably the most important work that ever got done in genetics outside of Mendel, happened in this really haphazard, dirty room in the middle of New York City.
And the fact that Morgan was eventually able to get behind both theories, what effect did that endorsement have on the scientific community?
It was really important because he did, again, have a reputation as being someone who was very hard to convince about something. So if people said, well, even Thomas Hunt Morgan got convinced of it, that really was a good endorsement. He was also known as a very popular person, very congenial, very nice to people, always had a lot of people on his side. And so he was able to bring a lot of people together and just kind of make a community out of them. He was very good, for example, about sharing his stocks of flies. So other people started working with fruit flies as well. And again, it got sort of it kind of bonded the entire community. And that stands in contrast to probably his most brilliant assistant, whose name was Hermann Müller, Hermann Müller, I guess is how you would say it. And Müller was just as smart as Morgan, perhaps even smarter than Morgan. But Müller really had kind of a nasty reputation as being very snippy. He would get sort of mad at people and kind of chop them down if he didn't think they're worth it. If he thought their thinking was muddled or something like that. So he just wasn't able to bring people together in the same way that Morgan was. So again, it was one of those cases where it was not only the scientific work, it was kind of the human qualities that helped make him the really important figure that he was.
Actually, Müller was a very interesting character in this book. Now, he was the one who, he didn't even have to use a microscope to see the flies. He would just look in the bottle, correct?
I think that was actually Calvin Bridges, one of his assistants. It was one of Morgan's. Yeah, it was Calvin Bridges that did that. Bridges was the one who was kind of a playboy and he kept getting in trouble for his extracurricular activities, so to speak. He was a believer in free love, which in the 19-teens and 1920s made him pretty unusual. He eventually actually ended up kind of divorcing his wife and leaving his children, getting a vasectomy, putting this moonshine distillery in his apartment, and would basically proposition any female that he met. He ended up doing a lot better than you might think with that direct approach, but... A lot of awkward moments.
I don't know how any science got done in that office.
Yeah, with all the fighting and, who knows.
We have a question from the chat from Loxloy.
Anyone who has taken high school biology is taught about Punnett squares. Was Reginald Punnett's contribution to science any greater than that?
And do explain what that is, because I've never heard that term.
If you're looking at dominant and recessive traits, let's just look at tallness. So if you're talking about the traits that a plant would have, you can think about the capital T as the dominant trait and a small t as a recessive trait. So they would be short if they had two small t's. The Punnett square, what you do when you look at the father and the mother, so to speak, with plants coming together. So you put the two T's on top and then the two T's on the side, and you look at how they intersect. So it makes kind of a little grid shape. It's basically a simple way to figure out all of the possibilities
right. When
you're crossing a mother with a father. And about the man who made them, I don't know a lot about him, but I do remember a biology teacher in college telling us he was actually a very sophisticated mathematician. He worked with biology and mathematics and did a lot of really good work in evolution and distributions of genes, things like that. But it's for this one very simple 2x2 square that he is kind of known today. So I guess that's the way history treats you. You do all this work and then you get remembered for probably the most simplistic thing you ever did.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking with Sam Keen, the author of The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. Now, there were so many stories in this book, and it was very, very difficult to choose which ones we should talk about on air. So given that everyone has sort of a background now, we can go straight to the creepy ones.
Okay. Excellent.
Thank you. Apparently, explorers' tales of ghost white bears that stalked men, bears that if you killed them and ate them would curse you and cause your skin to peel off, can teach us a little something about genetics.
It can. So these were polar bears, obviously, we're dealing with. And there's a long, long history of people exploring the Arctic, basically just attacking polar bears and trying to kill as many as they could, as quickly as they could, because the polar bears were pretty aggressive. They would stalk people down. They would kill them. And for whatever reason, the explorers thought it was kind of their duty to wipe out the polar bear, was basically what they wanted to do. The story I focus on in the book is the story of some people who basically tried to push too far into the Arctic Ocean too late into the season, ended up getting caught in ice and kind of marooned on this island above Siberia, which tells you how cold it is if it's way above Siberia. So they were stuck there all winter in a little tiny hut that they had to build themselves. And there were polar bears constantly attacking them, either killing men or stealing their food, things like that. And they decided one day they were going to get their revenge on the polar bears. And they'd had a lot of trouble killing polar bears before this. You can put a lot of bullets into a polar bear and it will not go down. But eventually, one night, they ended up killing a polar bear and ended up killing another few over the next few days and decided they were going to have a big feast. And so they were cooking up all the parts of the polar bear, its heart, all of its muscles, its brain, everything. And they made this really delicious stew, they thought. Except they also included in there the polar bear liver, which is bad, bad news. Because the polar bear liver, for various reasons, is super saturated with vitamin A. And vitamin A is a very essential nutrient, especially in developing organisms. It works with a lot of different DNA inside your body, and it helps kind of give you your basic body plan. It's really, really important in some of our most fundamental genes. It really works with them to help with turning them on, things like that. But if you get too much vitamin A inside you, it can do a couple of different things. It starts to work with switches, genetic switches inside your skin cells especially. And it also goes after the membranes of your cells and basically acts like a detergent. You have these nice fatty membranes around your cells. And vitamin A, if there's too much of it, will break those fatty membranes down. And the insides, the guts of the cell, start leaking out inside you. And this causes various problems like headaches, very severe cramps, things like that. But the really horrific thing that happened to these explorers was that their skin started to come off. And not just like little flaking bits of skin, like whole sheets of skin peeling off of you at one time. And we now know that's a characteristic of vitamin A poisoning, is that your skin just starts to come off your body in huge sheets. And it wasn't just these one explorers. That's the story I focus on in the book. There's actually a lot of stories of a lot of different people eating polar bear livers or seal livers or Arctic husky livers, all these different animals that store vitamin A in their livers for whatever reason. When you eat that, it doesn't go well in humans, and you have a lot of really disgusting things happen to you.
Seeing you, of course, see why I wanted to talk about this one. But let's go a little bit deeper into that. How did the polar bear evolve that kind of liver and why?
Again, the vitamin A works with a lot of different things in especially young animals, and especially with the skin cells. So if you're looking at an animal like a seal, seals live in probably the most demanding environment possible. They're living in 35 degree water up near the Arctic Circle, but they're mammals, so they need to have a nice high body temperature. And the way they've solved this problem is they just pack a lot of blubber onto their skin, nice inches thick layer of blubber and nice thick skin on top of that. And vitamin A is vitally important for building up a lot of nice thick blubber and nice thick skin. So seal mothers, they actually have a lot of vitamin A inside their body so that they can give it to their nursing seals in their milk, and so that the seals can grow this blubber layer very, very quickly. So that's where it really comes from ultimately. Polar bears, they need to be able to tolerate a lot of vitamin A in their diet because their primary source of food is these seals. And if they couldn't tolerate a lot of vitamin A, they would basically have no food source. So their livers have become kind of this biohazard containment facility inside them that absorbs all this vitamin A in their bloodstream, keeps it away from the rest of their body, and, you know, deals with it, does whatever it needs to with it. And of course, polar bears need their own vitamin A sources so they can pack blubber onto their skin as well. So it's kind of a double benefit for them. They can eat seals and they get blubber themselves. Humans, though, humans have a bit of a problem when we try to cheat up the food scale like this because our livers and our bodies simply can't handle as much vitamin A. And this substance called retinol, very closely related to vitamin A, it starts circulating in the bloodstream, and that's when all of these other problems happen. And we know, actually, that humans have been learning this lesson the hard way for a very long time. There's actually a Homo erectus skeleton, I believe, from about 1.3 million years ago, where they can see signs on its bones of vitamin A poisoning. It causes, I think, this pitting on the surface of the bones. And so, apparently, people were eating the mega carnivores back then and were eating their livers too and suffering from some of the same traits that you see in Arctic explorers. It probably wasn't polar bears back then, but people, again, we keep learning the lessons the hard way.
See, we're slow. and so I'm going to consider that our public service announcement for today. Don't eat polar bear livers. Yeah. Or maybe at least first evolve some way to metabolize massive quantities of vitamin A, perhaps?
Yeah. And actually, it's sort of interesting that Eskimos and people in Siberia, they actually had taboos against eating the polar bear liver, and they would tell the explorers coming in from Europe this, but they thought it was kind of a vulgar prejudice, like worshiping trees or something. They thought it was just these simplistic people who actually, there's wisdom in taboos sometimes, as they found out.
And we'll be right back with more of Sam Keen and his book, The Violinist's Thumb, after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll listen back to highlights from The Chilling Effects of Denialism and Who Will Save the Polar Bears, two panels on climate change recorded live at Convergence 2012. Science writer Maggie Kurth Baker, engineering professor John Abraham, science advocate and writer Sean Otto, and biological anthropologist Greg Layden discussed the causes and effects of climate change and how debate over the science has played out in the media and popular culture. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and my guest today is author Sam Keen. He's written The Violinist's Thumb and other lost tales of love, war, and genius as written by our genetic code. So since we're kind of already talking about mutations, maybe we should actually define that. What is a mutation exactly?
A mutation is any time that a gene gets altered or damaged or something like that. So genes are just stretches of DNA that make a protein or that do something else inside your body. And DNA is made up of these discrete chemicals. They sometimes call them letters, A, C, G, and T. And those are what store the information. They're kind of your blueprint inside alongside you. But if these bases, the A, C, G, and T, get changed, or, you know, a bit gets snipped out or damaged somehow, that can cause what's known as a mutation. And that can end up changing a body trait, usually for the worse. But that's the basic idea, is a gene gets damaged or otherwise changed, and the body trait ends up changing as well.
Okay, so there are different kinds of mutations.
Yeah, there are. There are a lot of different kinds. There's one called a point substitution, where you change one letter to another letter. There are some where large segments of DNA get deleted from you completely. There are also these things called DNA punctuation. It acts a lot like a period at the end of a sentence telling you to stop. Sometimes the period gets erased, and so the genetic sentence runs on and on and on. Sometimes a change happens, and a period gets inserted too soon in the sentence, so it gets kind of truncated. The worst mutation is something known as a frameshift mutation. When you're looking at how DNA works, the things that read DNA in your cells, they read three letters at a time. So they might look at ACT or GGC. They just work in triplets, three letters at a time. But when you have a frameshift mutation, something gets inserted into one of those triplets. And it not only screws up that triplet, it screws up every single other triplet down the line because, again, the frame gets shifted a little bit. So it can't read these nice consecutive groups of three anymore. Everything gets mixed up. And those are usually the worst mutations because, again, everything down the line gets screwed up as well. So plenty of different types of mutations out there.
So what kind of mutations then would radiation cause? Because you used radiation as an example. You wrote about the only person to have been officially exposed to both the radiation at Hiroshima and at Nagasaki, which is, wow, that's some luck.
Probably the unluckiest man of the 20th century right there. His name was Tsutomu Yamaguchi, who happened to be in Hiroshima right around August 6th. He was there temporarily, exposed to the nuclear bomb there, and had a very big struggle to get on a train leaving Hiroshima, did, but unfortunately his hometown was Nagasaki, so he ended up showing up right in time for the other nuclear bomb to go off. And I use this story because, as you said, radiation does damage your genes. And in fact, radiation kind of selectively goes after your DNA. That's the thing inside the cell it really damages. And the most common thing to happen with radiation damage is that you get large segments of DNA deleted from you. The analogy I like to use is imagine one of those old telephone cords, back when phones had telephone cords. Sometimes if you pulled them too hard, they kind of got all twisted up and knotty and gnarly. Mm-hmm. Imagine now a little bit of radioactivity streaking through. It can cut that cord in a lot of different places, and there's a lot of free ends kind of exposed there. Your cell has to go in, it has to solder all of these snipped pieces back together, but your cell doesn't know exactly how they were arranged in the first place. So it sometimes ends up soldering things in the wrong order, or it leaves little things out, and they get deleted from your cells, essentially.
Now, how does this work? Because I thought DNA could repair itself to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it depends a little bit on the type of damage that you sustain. DNA is kind of famously, its shape is the double helix. So there are two strands of DNA that are woven together. So if one side of the DNA strand gets damaged, it's very easy for a cell to fix that. That's usually not a problem. It's when both strands get damaged that cells have problems because the cell doesn't know how to fix when both sides get damaged, a cell doesn't know how to fix that. So there are some mutations that we can bounce back from pretty easily. And as I explained in the book, that's probably one of the reasons that Yamaguchi not only survived both of the nuclear explosions, he actually lived until 2010. He lived 65 extra years after getting exposed to both of these nuclear bombs, probably because his cells had very, very good DNA repair proteins inside them. He was maybe just kind of lucky that his cells were as good as they were at doing this. And he probably also didn't have some of these double strand breaks, the ones that really cause a lot of damage and can lead to things like cancer very easily in the future if you're exposed to radiation.
Well, how about the DNA that's passed on to the children of radiation survivors? What happens there?
This was actually something I was very surprised about in the book. It was pretty obvious very quickly that the people at Hiroshima and Nagasaki suffered from very high rates of cancer, especially. And so you would expect, because, again, you're passing DNA from parent to child and radiation damages DNA, you'd expect a lot of problems in the next generation as well, higher rates of cancer, birth defects, things like that. But they really didn't find that. They found that there really wasn't any higher incidence of anything, cancer, birth defects, anything, among the children of people who survived the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. And it really surprised a lot of people that they seem to have kind of escaped this. And no one quite knows why. Probably it was a combination of things. One is that you only pass on certain DNA inside you in your sperm and egg cells to the next generation. So, you know, if your liver or skin gets damaged, that damage won't get passed on. It's only certain DNA. The other thing is that most of the potential problems are usually recessive genetic mutations. So you need to inherit two bad copies of a gene in order to have the birth defect or the disorder. But the odds of both of your parents randomly getting the same gene damaged inside them were pretty low. So actually, among the children, there wasn't much of an incidence of these problems in the next generation.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking about DNA and genetics with Sam Keen, author of The Violinist's Thumb. All right, we have a bunch of audience questions, but okay. I also have some other questions. So I will, let's do some audience ones first, because I will not be selfish today. Now, there's a couple of questions, actually, about your very first story. This one's from Tony from the website.
Did Paganini pass on flexible hands to any offspring?
He did have a son who was a violinist, too, and I've never seen anything that said the son had really amazing hands like that. So as far as I know, I don't think it passed on. It maybe just didn't get passed on to the next generation. So yeah, I don't think that he did, actually.
We have just enough time to talk about one more way that genes are affected by outside sources, microbes. Now, viruses and bacteria can give us new genes?
They can. They're a little insidious, viruses especially, because they can actually take their DNA, insert it inside our DNA, and trick our cells into making more copies of them. That is how a lot of viruses work. HIV is probably the best known example of a virus that works this way. In fact, this process has happened so often in human beings that 8% of our DNA overall is just old, broken down virus DNA sitting inside us. And actually only 2% of our DNA is the DNA that makes the proteins, that's our genes that make us go. So by that measure, we're kind of four times more virus than we are human. And everyone wants to know, like, oh my God, what is this virus DNA doing inside us? That's so creepy. And most of it doesn't really do anything. It's, again, kind of broken down. Mutations have turned it off or whatever, and it doesn't do much. But there are cases where this virus DNA does do things and important things inside us. Probably the most amazing example is with the human placenta. This is the interface between the fetus and the uterus of the mother. And in its very early days, the embryo needs to kind of fuse with the uterus. It needs to kind of lock onto there and anchor itself onto there. Well, the primary protein that it uses to fuse onto the uterus is actually an old virus DNA. Because viruses, they're very good at locking onto cells, to fusing with cells so they can invade them. And it seems that we basically kind of stole this gene from viruses and used it to make the placenta. So that is the ultimate origin of the placenta, is from a virus.
Also still creepy.
Extremely creepy, yes.
Well, we'll just continue on with the creepy because that's how I roll. Some kinds of bacteria can steal animal DNA and use them against us. And I'm thinking, of course, of Toxoplasma, because I wanted to save the most creepy for last. So how does it work?
This is sort of the opposite scenario, in that this is a case where, as you said, a microbe stole a gene from us. The toxoparasite is a cat parasite. It wants to be inside cats because that's where it can reproduce. And specifically, it needs to be inside the cat digestive tract. It's kind of a strange fetish, but that's where it needs to be, is in the cat digestive tract. So when it finds itself outside the cat digestive tract, it's always scheming for a way to get back inside there. And it found a very clever way to do this. We know a lot about this, especially in how it works in mice. The toxoparasite will invade mice. It will go straight for their brain, and it will start pumping out a biochemical called dopamine inside their brain. It basically stole this gene to produce dopamine from mammals, and it starts making this inside the mice brain. And what this does is that mice are usually very scared of cats. It's a hardwired fear. They're especially afraid of cat smells. They won't go near a cat smell unless they have toxo inside their brain, at which point they're actually attracted to the cat smell. So they run after a cat smell. The cat, of course, plays along. It pounces. It eats the mouse. And the toxo ends up back inside the cat. Now, again, we know this works in mice, and it's very well characterized in mice. But we also know that toxo can invade other animals, including human beings. And we know that the toxo also goes straight for our brain. It goes to a place inside our brain called the amygdala, and it starts putting out brain chemicals inside human beings. And this is extremely eerie to think about, this thing inside us pumping out these biochemicals. And they haven't done controlled scientific studies on this. So it's something that they're still working on, what exactly it does in humans. But the scientists who do work on it realize that this might explain kind of the cultural phenomenon of crazy cat ladies. Because when you hear about people who hoard animals, they're usually hoarding cats. That's when they usually have, you know, hundreds of animals around. It's usually cats. And this might provide some of the explanation for why, is that they're attracted to the odor of cats. It's doing something to their brain, and they get kind of addicted to having cats around. Now, it probably doesn't explain everything about this. There are other factors, but it does provide some plausible biological basis for the crazy cat lady.
And we've discussed this on the show over and over again, because I am never, ever going to get tired of this. That is the closest thing to, I think, what could create real zombies. And I know I'm speculating, everybody, and I'm sure I'll get emails, but I'm entranced by this. So we are almost out of time. I think we have time for one more question.
Sure.
This is from Kevin.
Are there any stories that you learned later that you wish you could have put in the book?
Yes, there is. There's one in particular about chimney sweeps, and it's kind of an exploration of cancer and DNA, because cancer is basically a DNA disease. The basic story is that the chimney sweeps, in London particularly, were exposed to a chemical that gave them a very aggressive type of skin cancer. It was actually scrotal cancer that they came down with. And it was kind of this amazing detective work of this doctor, Percival Pott, in 1775, hunting down why the chimney sweeps were getting cancer. And of course, Pott didn't know about DNA and how things work like that. But in combination with modern knowledge, you can really see how incredible this whole story was of the chimney sweeps and pot figuring all this out. So I wish I had had found that out in time for the book. But I do give a version of it in my talk if anyone wants to come out and see that.
Sam, you're lovely. Thanks very much for coming back to the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It was a great hour.
You can find the link to Sam Keen and his book, The Violinist's Thumb, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Since you're there, why not click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so that you can be the first to hear about our live episodes, and of course to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the program or check out the archives. One last thing. I'm here with Maria Walters, writer at skeptic.org, and we'd like to talk a little bit about the DragonCon Star Party. Welcome back, lady.
Hey, good to be here.
So first off, what is DragonCon?
DragonCon is a huge science fiction and fantasy convention that happens on Labor Day weekend every year. The folks from Skepticality, so Derek and Swoopy, actually run a full skeptics track at DragonCon. They always have a great lineup of people, and we do all kinds of fun skeptic stuff in the midst of 50,000 science fiction and fantasy people who are, you know, dressed as Luke Skywalker.
Really, 50,000 Luke Skywalkers? That's actually almost kind of frightening.
It's pretty impressive.
So what is the Star Party then?
The Star Party is something we've been doing for 4 years. This is our fourth year. And what we do is we take advantage of all the cool people who are coming in for DragonCon. The night before DragonCon starts, we throw a cocktail party for charity. So we basically get some astronomers, some musicians, and we go and look at the stars and have some drinks and have a great time.
Tell us about last year so people get a sense of what it's like.
Yeah, so last year we did it up at the Emory Observatory, and Phil Plait and Pamela Gay were our astronomer guests. George Rabb did all the music. We had about 175 people. It was just a fantastic time. We got to use the Emory scopes and look at stuff. It was really a ton of fun. This year, our lineup is we have Phil coming back, which will be fantastic. We also have Nicole Gallucci, who's going to be our second astronomer. And we are also going to have George Rabb again, and then Marion Call is going to be doing the music as well. So we're super excited. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're actually changing the venue a little bit this year. We're actually doing it at a bar restaurant, which has a rooftop area. So we'll have scopes up. And we're actually trying to do some fun stuff with Fraser Kane, who does the Google+ Hangouts. We are still working through the technical details, but we're hoping to be able to stream in some cool stuff from astronomers around the world as well.
And I do want to point out, just for anybody who doesn't know, maybe just tell us a little bit about Marion Call.
Marion Call is a sort of geek folk musician, I guess is the best way to describe her.
Yeah.
She's just amazing. She actually lives in Alaska. And her goal, I think it was last year, she decided she wanted to do a show in every state in the U.S. So she basically put the call out, and she did house parties and, you know, coffee houses in every state in the country. And so, earlier this year, she came into Atlanta, and so we got to meet her and hang out with her, and she was just fantastic. She's a huge science fan, and as soon as she heard about the Star Party, she was like, I want to do this. So we're really lucky to have her. She is going to be really amazing, and I think everybody will really enjoy her work. And she and George have worked together in the past, so I'm sure they'll be doing a lot of stuff together in addition to doing her stuff on her own. It'll be great.
So what you're saying is if someone was to miss this, they will be kicking themselves later.
Yeah, I think this is going to be, I think we are every year trying to top ourselves, and I think this is going to be one of the best we've ever done. I really think this lineup is fantastic. Some of the things we're trying to do with the technology is going to be really cool. And it's for a really great cause. So all the proceeds go to Light the Night, which is the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And the party itself is in honor of Jeff Medkeff, who was an astronomer known as the Blue Collar Scientist. And he was a writer, a skeptic, and a friend to a lot of us. And unfortunately, Jeff died of liver cancer in 2008. And so ever since then, we've been throwing this in his memory. And so we really think this is a great cause. This year, we're actually teaming up with Foundation Beyond Belief, and they are running a Light the Night team as well. They're actually a national team this year, and as part of this national team, they actually have a matching program. So up to $500,000, they will match. So our goal for the national team is $500,000, and so we're really happy because everything we contribute will basically be doubled.
This actually sold out last year, did it not?
It has sold out every year.
Right.
We're on track to do the same this year. We still have tickets available for sure. But the best place to go is atlantaskeptics.com/starparty. And all of the information is there, and you can buy the tickets right there on the website. It should be super easy.
Awesome. And I'm very sorry to miss out on it this year because it sounds amazing.
Yeah, we're going to miss you, but we're actually, like I said, hoping that we may be able to stream some of it, so maybe you can peek in for a little bit.
I absolutely will. Thanks very much, Maria.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
And that's it for us. We'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically, that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.